This Week in Radio Tech is sponsored by Axxia. Axxia, with over 2,000 consoles on the air around the world. Axxia is the leader in IP audio. And now with the new PowerStation, it's the easiest too. Check them out at axxiaaudio.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twert.
Kind of branching out into different digital initiatives that don't really have any ties to their core competency, which is broadcasting and entertainment.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up,
Dad? Yeah, all your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
On this episode of Twert, we're talking pet peeves as well as the news of the day with Chris Tobin and with Chris Tarr.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. Hello there, I'm Kirk Harnack and I'm your host. Very glad to be with you, and I got a couple of great co-hosts with me for the show today. This is the show where we talk about radio technology. And on this episode, we're talking about pet peeves of engineers. Wouldn't you like to know? And I'll bet if you're an engineer watching or listening to this show, you're gonna share with us. Oh, speaking of sharing with us, you can share your pet peeve in the chat room. If you're watching or listening to the show live, you can go to irc.twit.tv and join in the chat room there. You can also get to it from the live.twit.tv website and join there. If you're listening to the show afterwards, you can certainly go to the website, thisweekinradiotech.com, and go to the forum, or you can actually go to the show notes for this particular show and leave us some interesting comments right there. We'd be glad if you would. Hey, let's bring in our co-host right now. Joining me on this show is the best-dressed engineer in radio. It's Chris Tobin from Manhattan. Hey, Chris.
Hello, Kirk. How are you?
I'm good. What's going up in your world?
Oh, let's see. Today we launched a new program on one of our sports stations, and now on television you get to see it on the Madison Square Garden Network, Boomer and Carton, Boomer Esiason and Craig Carton. So this morning was an early day for me. That's why I have a little bit of a scruffiness. We launched at 6 a.m. and high-definition television. So our radio station not only does audio, but we do 8 hours a day of live video. It's actually more than the local TV affiliate here in New York City. So as
radio stations start doing more video than TV stations, you got something going there.
Well, yeah, you know, a lot of the television stations, they run those soaps. That's all on tape, or, you know, it's recorded. It's nothing live. Live to air is what, the morning news, and then it's a network newscast, so it's technically not your live local. So, yeah, we've been adding up the time, and it's growing. I think we're up to 8 or 9 hours a day of video along with the radio. So it's good. So here at the CBS radio stations in New York City.
The Fox affiliate where I do some work at, they do 5.5 hours a day of live local programming.
Yeah.
So maybe, you know, 4 hours in the morning, an hour and a half at night. So interesting. Hey, also with us from Mukwonago, Wisconsin.
Ah, you got it.
That right?
Mukwonago, correct.
Hey, I thought about, you know, Chief. Actually, my daughter told me what a muck was, or at least that she had learned. And I can't remember what it was now, but it made it real. It was really fun. Like a bear. She said, "Oh, muck! Oh, that's a bear. That's a bear."
Yeah, it is. Mukwonago stands for Place of the Bear.
Oh well, there you go.
So she got it right. And we don't. We're not doing video yet. We just got, you know, electricity and running water here not too long ago. So. At some point, we'll actually, you know, do some of those talking pictures, but, you know, I think that's a passing fad.
So your stations are doing nothing streaming like Ustream or?
No, I was joking. We actually have probably one of the better video producers in radio working for us, and we have a full Pro Tools or a full Final Cut rig and a bunch of high-end video cameras and stuff. So we actually do a lot of not only professional video production, but we also do, you know, the Ustream and that sort of thing as well.
Wow, interesting. So, Chris, you work for the Entercom stations up there in Wisconsin. Well, what's your job?
I do. We have three radio stations in Madison, three radio stations in Milwaukee, and I'm the director of engineering.
Cool. And Mr. Tobin, you work in New York for CBS. You find them some new ways to get revenue from the engineering department.
Oh, that's correct. Yes, as broadcast technologists, I look for the technologies that help us generate revenue. And so far, it's been doing well. I'm still employed. It's a nice sign.
And speaking of employed, the folks at Telos, Omnia, and Axxia are my employers, and I appreciate very much them letting me have the evening off every Wednesday to do this. Hey, let's jump right into it. I saw a headline that came along here recently. It's BBG says its broadcasts draw 165 million listeners weekly. That's a bunch. And the BBG, what is that? Well, it's the Broadcasting Board of Governors. Those are the folks who run entities like the Voice of America and Radio Free Asia. It says they've done some research. Their newest performance and accountability report, because you know they are spending U.S. tax dollars as quasi-federal agencies. They released numbers this week. They broadcast with they reach 165 million people a week over various platforms. Some of the interesting things in Afghanistan, Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, Radio Azadi and Voice of America's Afghan service reached 65% of adults in Afghanistan. In Burma, it's the first ever national radio survey there found that some 8 million people tune into Radio Free Asia and the Voice of America. And they also have substantial listenership in Iran, Iraq, and Indonesia. That's amazing. I knew these entities were out there. I've been to a couple of locations. The Radio Free Liberty new facility in Prague, Czech Republic, and it's very impressive. But man, I had no idea they were reaching this many people. It's outside the U.S. It's not something that we U.S. engineers normally think about. Mr. Tobin and Mr. Tarr, you got any thoughts about this? We're reaching this many people a week?
Sure. Worldwide radio, it's the old days of shortwave, Voice of America, Radio Marti. It's a way of communicating to the outside what goes on here in the States. It's an interesting political approach to spreading the word through radio. I think they also have television, too. There's some TV components in the BBG, yep. Believe it or not. So they have some of the largest antenna arrays, antenna farms. If you want to see some like low frequency arrays, it's some pictures on one of the websites. It's pretty wild. It's almost the size of several, national parks, and they transmit the signal and bounce it off the sky and get around the world.
I'm told that they're not doing so much shortwave anymore. They've decommissioned a number of sites. In fact, what they're doing is they're doing a lot of FM, and they may be doing some AM too. I don't have the numbers as to their breakout. In fact, we should get a friend of mine. Bill Klein on from Prague, Czech Republic. He's a U.S. national. I mean, he's a U.S. guy, and he's the director of engineering for Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty in Prague. And oh, what a beautiful site! I mean, just the facility is fabulous. Bill could give us some real insight on this kind of thing. But they do use a lot of FM transmitters, even in places where they have to go lease FM transmitters in a country. And they're doing the internet. They're doing a whole lot of internet now too. I think
they drop radio transmitters in various countries with permission, of course, and they relay and broadcast to the masses that way. They do AM. There's AM. I read an article in many parts of like third world countries, if you will. AM seems to be prevalent over that of FM for I guess whatever reason. Maybe it's easier to buy AM radios, or it just so happens to be that way. But yeah, they still do a lot. Yeah, shortwave they did cut back on. That's true. But I believe they've kept a few in place just to, pepper the world with something via shortwave, because it's still a popular medium in parts of the world that we probably would never even think of.
Currently, their FM broadcasts are getting jammed in Iran.
Oh, so. I'm surprised.
Yeah. Hey, I thought that was interesting. You want to read more? It's on Radio World Online there. Hey, here's another topic that it comes up every few months, and it's here again. It's the birds versus towers debate, and it's leading to a public hearing. The next step is one in which environmental groups claim the tower lights are confusing migratory birds and cause them to fall and die. Well, they have wings. While broadcasters and cell tower owners dispute these claims, the matter is receiving particular public attention during Michael Powell's Powell's tenure as chairman of the FCC, and it's been continuing ever since. To comply with obligations under the National Environmental Policy Act, the FCC is conducting what it's calling a programmatic environmental assessment on antenna structure registration program to evaluate its potential environmental effects. That's because a federal appeals court ruled in 2008 that broadcast and cellular towers may have a significant environmental effect on migratory birds. The commission will consider alternatives to address potential environmental effects and determine whether a more extensive analysis, like a programmatic environmental impact statement may be required. As part of the process, the commission is holding public hearings December 6th, a couple weeks from now, at FCC headquarters, also at December 13th in Chula Vista, California, and December 15th in Tampa, Florida. They're seeking public comment, and we'll stick this in the show notes. There are articles on Radio World Online. It's rwonline.com. Comments are due by January 14th. So I figured broadcast engineers who have some knowledge of what is going on with tower lights and birds, well, you may want to make comment there by January the 14th. The docket numbers are on the RW Online website. Mr. Tarr, you got dead birds around your towers? Are you a bird killer?
You know, I yeah, I'm a bird killer. You know, what? no, I do see, occasionally we'll see them around the tower area. But again, you know, it's hard to say, you know, in 7 years, I may have seen two or three. And I've got a huge, I've got five 500-foot towers right outside the back door. So, you know, is that more than I would find anywhere else? Now, keeping in mind, I'm in a kind of a swampland, wildlife type of area. So who's to say that wasn't just, you know, nature at work? So, you know, I don't know. I have two schools of thought on it. One is, you know, where there's smoke, there's probably a little fire. On the other hand, you know, there's that great story about many, many years ago in western Wisconsin, there was supposedly this huge bird kill dealing with a tower farm. I mean, and you know, made the papers or anything. And one of the engineers involved went back in time to kind of trace back where this all started and interviewed all these people who, you know, were talking about it. And nobody could really remember seeing it happen. Yeah, it was one of those things where it was more of an urban legend than anything. So, I certainly think it has to be studied. There's no doubt about it. Do I really think there's much to it? Not really.
Mr. Tarr, you got that problem there in Manhattan? Well, you got transmitter sites that are outside Manhattan.
Yes, three of our AMs have outdoor sites. One of them is on, two of them are on an island, plenty of birds or geese. Can't say that we found any dead ones in the last 7-8 years. My other site has four towers, 500-foot towers in the swamps of the Meadowlands. And there, too, if we did have any dead birds, I probably wouldn't see them because it would require hip waters and out into the swamp to see what's, you know, that's out there. And trust me, when it's low tide, there are some things that you just don't want to be looking at in the swamp. We've done work on the overnights and during the summer, and it's amazing the things that will that come out of the grass, or the Aphromites, the large cattail, swamp weeds, and the fish that we have. And there's muskrats. We got muskrats that come out and sit on the roadside by each of the towers. So it's got to be very careful at night when you're driving between towers. But birds falling, hitting towers. We have strobes during the day. I haven't had any issues. I would agree with Chris. I'm suspect about this towers and migrant birds and, you know, species being lost because of broadcasters in their way. It just doesn't seem to, you know, hold water. But that's just
me. I think there's got to be a lot more birds lost to plate glass windows on skyscrapers than to I've lived in homes that, I mean, every year we'd have two or three birds just fly full speed into a plate glass window. I can't. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, well, try this one on for size. If you're worried about birds and being impacted by, you know, human elements, how about the plane that landed in the Hudson as a result of birds being sucked into the engine from the LaGuardia Airport?
Oh, yeah. Exactly. As far as I'm concerned, it's fair play. I think, you know what? Get those birds. Send them back to where they came from.
It's fair play. There you go. Okay, fine. You know what? Money could be better spent elsewhere than the FCC doing that whole study, because it's like there was a study for federal funding 5 years ago for turtles, something about turtles. I remember hearing a PSA on a radio station. I'm like, wow, how does this work? Why are we studying the migration of turtles in some part of the South? It was made no sense. That's where this is going.
You know, there is that point, you know, as we face one of the largest federal deficits ever, you know, that we're studying this.
Right.
Yeah, there's
exactly
something to that problem.
Look, if there's something to it, I want to be the first guy to figure out, okay, how do we mitigate it? I just have such a hard time believing that there's anything to it. Now, could there have been an incident here or there in the last few decades where some birds died at a tower site? Absolutely. But sure. Was the cause then, or is there any causation now on a regular basis of birds being lured to a tower by its mystical flashing red light in just the right cloud conditions where the birds may be confused? And, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's possible. I do know that in Nashville, there is a group of people who've been studying dead birds occurring around the Channel 4 WSMV TV tower site. And that is, it's, you know, big, full 1,000-foot tower, maybe a little higher than 1,000 feet. And it's been there for a long time. It's on a hill. It's visible for a long time, for long ways. And I'm sure it's got to be in some, you know, flyways where birds go. And I need to look that back up. The last time I read about that, there was nothing conclusive. You know, they find dead birds. I think a number of people in this group go look for dead birds either every day or a couple times a week or once a week, but on a real regular basis for years and even decades they've been doing this. They have some evidence, but is it conclusive? I don't think it is. But I that does deserve a second look before I completely poo-poo it. But the point of I want to bring this up is that if you want to make comments on the RW Online website, you'll easily find the article. I found it in a few seconds, and you can make some comments to the FCC. Any final comments before we move on to the next one?
Cut funding. Cut the funding. That's it. We're done. You know, radio towers have been around since 1929 to start with broadcasting, and we have more than, what, two hands worth of birds that we found on the floor? I mean, come on. This is ridiculous.
And I can't believe there's that big of a bird lobby.
It's amazing. That's what they come out of the woodwork. It's probably an NPR thing. That's what it is.
Who's funding these birds?
Hey, I get to see it on NPR now. Birds are dying everywhere.
Here's a story. You know, it's every major group has, you know, I guess is moving ahead with some kind of digital initiatives. That's a good word for it. Clear Channel has just named a fellow named Robert Pittman as their leader of digital technology and initiatives. He was chief executive officer at MTV and at AOL Networks and former COO of America Online and AOL Time Warner. He has invested money in the company and will develop an integrated digital strategy for Clear Channel Radio. Is Clear Channel making a good move here to put a high-profile executive in charge of digital initiatives?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Bob Pittman, you know, he has some history with broadcasters on many levels, many successes and some failures that we can all, you know, read up about. Some of them going back as far as NBC days and Bob Pittman in his early days. But he is a person who manages to think, we'll use the phrase, out of the box, is willing to take, I'll say, risks, understands what the user of the medium that he's involved in wants, whether it be video, MTV, whether it be radio, now this Clear Channel Initiative, or back in the days of WNBC AM. Some of the things he did were innovative, were ahead of their time. I think today, in this climate, and Chris, I'm sure, has the same experience at his radio stations, you cannot afford not to try something that is along the model of what you do in this business. And Bob Pittman is one of those folks, so like a Steve Jobs, that just sees something, looks at it, and realizes, yes, this does make sense, and our listeners, our consumers of our brand would want it. The trick is, if we introduce it, are we willing to accept their opinions, both positive and negative, and if there are negative sides, how do we quickly adjust ourselves? And he's definitely the kind of person that can do that. He takes no prisoners. And I think I applaud Clear Channel for trying to do something different. I mean, they're doing a lot of things they're doing right. A lot of things, yeah, they can use improvement. But I applaud them on that.
Mr. Tarr, does Entercom leave it up to your individual station clusters for a digital initiative? Or does you have a clear strategy for the company?
No, we do have a clear strategy, but I think it's important to note, first of all, you know, we've been saying forever that if you're not doing anything digital, you're missing the boat. However, you know, one of the things we need to be very cautious about as we head into this brave new world is that let's not forget our core competency, which is broadcasting.
Yep.
You know, I do see a lot of radio companies kind of branching out into different digital initiatives that don't really have any ties to their core competency, which is broadcasting and entertainment. So, you know, I see a lot of times I'll see people kind of chasing, I like to call it the shiny ball syndrome, where all of a sudden there's some great new technology and boom, they're out the door chasing it. And it doesn't really tie into what we do well. And, you know, what we do well is entertain and inform and do all these things with a radio station, which gives us a platform to drive these digital things and not kind of not the other way around. You know, a lot of times we see these great new technologies and go, oh, we got to figure out a way to monetize this and tie it in with the radio station. And you're kind of trying to fit this, you know, square peg into a round hole. But really, we need to say, how can we extend our brands? How can we take our radio stations into the digital age and make a digital component that, you know, brings our advertisers to our listeners? And I think we need to think out of the box, but we also need to be very cautious not to forget what we do.
Absolutely. Actually, you know, it's funny you say that. I was just talking with one of our program directors, VP of programming at my radio stations, and that's exactly what he was talking about. Don't worry about how it gets to the listener or, you know, whether you like it or not. Make sure the brand is the best that you have. Remember what we do as broadcasters and then make it available everywhere possible and let our audience choose what they want to use and how to consume it. And I think a lot of folks are not realizing that. He also ran along with that. And I said, well, HD radio gives you that opportunity. And he poo-pooed that right away. So,
There are ways to do it without, you know, there are ways to kind of make those round off those square pegs a little bit. For example, you know, we started doing that with video content where a lot of people were just doing Ustream and things like that. We actually started producing web only content featuring our radio personalities. And, you know, we now have something that drives people to the website just to see the things they can't hear on the radio. But, you know, there's that cross promotion thing going on and that sort of thing. But not only is there web content, but it's professionally produced. It's not, you know, this bad microphone in a closet somewhere with a 60-cycle hum in the background. It's done really well. We've invested the money into tools to do it right. And, you know, there's a case where 5 years ago, we didn't speak video at all. And right now, you know, now we're speaking, you know, green screens and you know, different types of microphones and really kind of diving into the video world. But that's a way of taking that digital and extending it.
So yeah, we do the same thing. Go ahead, Kurt.
You're finding out that TV really is just radio with pictures.
Yeah, it's true. Exactly.
go ahead, Mr. Tobin. What were you going to say?
I was just going to dovetail on what Chris was talking about. We at one of our stations, we have a on-air talent, John Montone, who is a very coarse individual and definitely has that snarky New York City attitude that a lot of folks enjoy. And our TV sister station, WCBS TV2, has taken that radio segment he does. It's a two-minute piece he does on the radio. And now has made it a video component and integrated as part of their news elements on the weekends. And you get to watch John do his thing live on video and then gets played back again on the website. So we went from a radio-only component where nobody ever saw what he looked like, just heard his comments about, hey, I rode in a New York City cab today and asked his opinion about what tourists do and what he likes or doesn't like. And it's a 2-minute, you know, rant. And then now the TV folks have taken that. Now we put a video camera with them. Same question, as approach, everything is the same, but now you get to see it and it's a hit. And it's like, you know, everyone's going, wow, you know, who knew? And it's just, it's wild. And so, you know, we're doing video and producing and it's a great time to be in radio if you can add video to it.
Yeah. And with the popularity of something like YouTube, I guess you can, it's how some videos go viral. I can imagine a crazy radio host who says and does and puts himself in crazy and interesting situations. When you add video to that, you could really add to his brand.
Yes, absolutely. And that's what we our CHR station, this year we did about 36 video Ustream events trying to figure, you know, try to tie stuff in. And now you can find up on YouTube as well. And coming this holiday season, we'll be doing more outdoor stuff with video and the audio and the branding and combination thereof. And, you know, it's just, I think it's great. I think Chris is right. You got to think of your core competencies and say, okay, how do we, you know, bring things around it and sort of an adjunct to what we do, not eliminate it or treat, you know, internet or video as something totally different as a new business model, but maybe an adjunct to our current business model that is strong and vibrant. And I think that's what you got to look at. And,
hey, switching gears, and speaking of content and video and rich content, I want to point out this product that's being promoted by Eric Rhodes at Radio Inc. magazine. It's called the Mighty Red. And if you haven't seen this, take a moment to go to your own. In fact, Burke, if you want to pop this up, the website is Mighty Red HD, M-I-G-H-T, Mighty Red, R-E-D, H-D, as in high definition, MightyRedHD.com. And you'll see this. I don't know if I want to call it beautiful, but it's really cute. This radio, what does it cost here? I think it's, is it $69, $79 or so? And it has a 2.5 by 3 inch, four color screen. Okay, well, the pictures that they have put on it look like a lot better than four colors. I don't know, maybe it's got yellow. So, it picks up, of course, FM and HD2 and HD3. You guys haven't been exposed to this at all yet? Have you seen this?
I've seen it. I've not had a chance to try and find out more about it, but yeah, I've heard about it, and looks pretty interesting. Worth
one thing I
try.
Like about about what Eric is promoting here is this web page that shows the screen of this radio. I think that Eric Rhodes wants station owners and managers and program directors to see this and to see what is possible. That you can have album art in sync with the music. And, as engineers, we know that, but actually getting it into the hands of a consumer on a $69 device, I think is kind of interesting. The station name, the album name, you have presets available. By the way, this is all on a touchscreen, so it's not, I guess, I don't know how the look and feel and the touch is, but it's not so different from that new iPod Nano. It has live pause, so it'll record for up to 15 minutes. So, if you got to take a break or talk to somebody.
Sorry to interrupt. That looks just like the brand new Insignia over at Best Buy. HD.
There you go, then. Maybe that's what it is. Is the brand new Insignia called the Mighty Red, or is this Eric Rhodes version of it?
No, I think it might be rebranded. It's the Insignia. And it's same kind of thing. Color touchscreen. You can do album art, live pause. And it's, I think it's $79 at Best Buy.
Huh. Okay. I can't find any pictures of the new Insignia on the interwebs. Do you have any URL?
I just bought two of them.
Really?
And they would look just like that. Yeah.
Yes. Here's one. Here's a picture at least at obsessible.com. Most of the pictures are of the older Insignia, the one that came out a couple of years ago. That
I'm seeing on the chat room here. Somebody mentioned that the original Red that he sold was the same as the original Insignia HD radio. So it sounds like he buys them from the manufacturer and just rebrands them.
Okay. Well, listen, if Eric can get the word out to station owners, managers, and people that, hey, look, here's what you can do if you will just let your engineer go get on the job and put these things in play, then you can have this kind of rich experience. Might be helpful to you. I think it would be.
A start. It's definitely a start.
It's a start. That's right.
Better than
FM chips and cell phones.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. I keep wondering. Yeah, I have this new G2 from T-Mobile with Google, and I don't know if it has an FM chip in it or not. I haven't looked that up. But if it does, it doesn't have an app that makes it run. And would I use it to listen to FM? I don't think so. I don't use it to listen to multimedia to songs and such. I do stream some radio stations on this thing and listen to some podcasts on it. But they're podcasts that are being streamed to me. They're not synced up podcasts. Well, you know what? This does have an app to download podcasts. I guess I have listened to a couple of them there if I just haven't had my iPad with me.
Well, the reason I say it's a start is because I'm working with our 18 to 24, if you will, actually probably younger, CHR formatted station a lot. And out at the events, when I go out to the outside broadcasts we do, I notice a lot of our audience, when they're listening to the radio station, not at the remote broadcast, but out on their own, they're using their cell phone. They to stream the audio. They listen to it on a streaming method. I've not met one person yet that uses a cell phone with the FM chip in it. Even though several folks did have the phone that had the chip in it, I looked at it, and talked to them about what they do, their experience with the radio station. And sure enough, the phone has it. They just like, nah, I don't bother. It's it's not worth the trouble. I just you know, stream it. I'm like, oh, interesting.
I'll tell you what, I've got people in my office who stream the radio station. The tower's right outside the window. So there you go. I couldn't believe when I was walking by. There's like four people streaming the radio station at their desk. I'm like, you see those big pieces of steel right outside the door there? Yeah, that's where the signals come from. You could probably pick it up with your teeth.
Hey, thanks to Eric Adler in the chat room who gave us a link for this Insignia radio at Best Buy. So I'm sure if you go to Best Buy's website and look up Insignia HD radio, you'll find it. But that was the new version of it. I wouldn't have been aware of it if it weren't for Eric Rhodes and his Radio Inc. magazine promoting it with the one with red all around it. I kind of like the black better, but I'm glad Eric is out there promoting it. That's kind of cool. All right. Hey, guys, we got the main topic to get to in just a minute. But first,
I want to tell you about our sponsor, which is Axia Audio. Now, I work for Axia, and I own some radio stations, and I've had an opportunity to build literally dozens of non-Axia studios, you know, traditional studios, either analog or digital, or in some cases with a TDM type of router. And I've had a chance to build several Axia studios, both at trade shows and in my own radio stations and in some of Axia's customers around the world. I got to tell you, IP audio is a fantastic technology. It's flexible, which means you can do a lot of different things with it, things you didn't even know when you got it. It's powerful, it's cost-effective, and people said, though, it was too hard to configure the network switch or switches because, yeah, it does take some command line operations with HP switches or with Cisco switches to get them properly configured for an IP audio network. So Axia went out and made it easy. They put a custom built-in pre-configured IP audio Ethernet switch inside the new PowerStation console system. There's no switch configuration. It is ready to go right out of the box. You can turn on the power. You can plug in your sources and plug in your speakers and your destinations. You can name those things in your browser. Just go in there with your browser. It's as easy as can be. And then you are ready to go. You don't really have to name them. You know, you could just use the default names. But if you want to name them like CD1, Mic1, CD2, Automation 1, 2, 3, 4, you do that. Watch the video about installing an Axia PowerStation console. It's on the axiaaudio.com webpage. It's on the front page. Just go to axiaaudio.com and you'll see two small videos there. You can watch them small size or blow them up bigger, and you'll see Rachel Bernard and me installing and configuring an Axia IP audio studio with PowerStation. There's no more punch blocks to mess with. There's no building up little ditty boxes to make a relay work, for example. No more messy and outdated documentation for your facility. Whether you're a little or a lot, whether you know a little or know a lot about IP audio, you can get an Axia console and PowerStation on the air literally in a few minutes. If it's your first time, it may take you a couple hours. But if you know what you're doing, literally a few minutes to get Axia up and running. Keeping up with friends on Facebook? Well, you can keep tabs on Axia and IP audio there as well. Just click on the Facebook button on the Axia Audio homepage at axiaaudio.com. So whether you're a small facility with one studio, medium-sized groups with maybe 5 to 12 studios, or even a large to massive facilities with 50 studios and room to grow, Axia connects easily to legacy consoles and equipment. I want you to hear that. Axia connects easily to legacy consoles and equipment. You don't have to change your whole facility to IP audio. You can add it in as your budget and time allows, and Axia will grow as you do. So there are over 2,000 Axia consoles on air around the world. Axia is the leader in IP audio, and now it's the easiest too. Let me encourage you. Go to axiaaudio.com and find out about it for yourself. It's easy. Watch a video, like Axia on Facebook if you're active there, and check out the white papers too if you want to dig in a little bit deeper at axiaaudio.com.
So the main topic tonight, today, whenever you're listening to the podcast, whenever tonight may be, we're going to talk about pet peeves. Pet peeves. If you're an engineer, surely, don't call me Shirley,
call
but
me
surely
Charlie.
You have been peeved at something, whether it's a transmitter or a design of a piece of equipment, or the fact that the antenna that's broken is 800 feet up in the sky on a piece of steel, and you can't get to it without hiring a tower crew. Or maybe it's maybe you're peeved at, you know, the way that people work with you or ask you to do things or tell you to do things. So, you know, all these things are areas where we can develop peeves. And the good thing about developing a peeve or having a peeve about something is that, you know, you might be induced to correct it if it's something you can correct. Or you might be inclined to contact a manufacturer and say, you know what's bothering me about this thing you make? And believe me, working for a manufacturer, I'm on the receiving end of that, you know, reasonably often. So what are your pet peeves? We're going to be looking in the chat room for pet peeves from the engineers who join us right there. So I certainly expect to hear from Eric and Jay Hollegren and everyone else. And Navion, if you're there. But let's run first to Chris Tobin in New York City. Chris, once in a while, surely, even a easygoing guy like you gets peeved. What are you peeved about?
Oh, well, let's see. My pet peeve, my peeve would be with, in this case, our Verizon folks, who for some reason, even though they do their best to claim that their, you know, progress is happening and everything is coming your way, every time we order any kind of special circuits they claim they know very well, they always send out somebody who doesn't have a clue. Talk to my rep. We're an enterprise account, which means we're supposed to get special service. Yeah, defined special in the world of Verizon. And I have a T1 going in or an ISDN line, some digital circuit. The guy comes out. He's a POTS installer, you know, plain old telephone service installer, and tells me the reason there's a problem with your T1, it's got static on the line. I'm like, yes.
There's no dial tone.
It's supposed to have static. He's like, no, you're missing the dial tone. I said, have you ever worked with T1s? Yes, all the time. Really? How about DS0, DS1? Does that ring a bell? Yes. Then, okay, you're in the wrong building. I've actually thrown people out of the building. My peeve is with Verizon and the ability to train people. I don't understand how they miss that connection. It's just annoying. But that's just me.
And that's not unique to Verizon. I'm doing the show today from Cleveland, Mississippi. But this was 10 years ago. I was down the road in Greenville, Mississippi, at a studio that we built to do a live morning show from Greenville, Mississippi, and I ordered an ISDN line, and it wasn't working right. Now, it had the static on it. It had the, you know, the pops and clicks on it, or the tick, 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 and it wasn't G-Hawn. And so we had the Bell South Tech come out, and yeah, he said the problem was, well, it has no dial tone. You need to, let me call the CEO and get you some dial tone on here.
Yeah, it's just mind-boggling. And as a matter of fact, this week I ordered some circuits for a holiday event that we're doing, a week-long Toys for Tots broadcast that's going to put us outside of the parking lot at a large mall, and we need to put some ISDN circuits in, some POTS lines, and, you know, make things happen. And I gave them the pole, the telephone pole, utility pole ID number, a picture of previously used network interface boxes on the pole, so there is definitely ability to bring service to this pole. And I took a picture of the actual cross-connect box, you know, the ones that hang on the cable span between poles. So you could see that's where they would break out the circuits. They managed to write back to me and say, no, you don't understand, that's not available. We can't do that. You need to give us a phone number of a location that we can look up in the database. I'm saying, so I had to write back. So what if a car hits this pole, takes out the service that pole is part of, how would you go about replacing it? Do you go to the mall
cell phone number, the
and
car.
Get an address? Yeah. I was like, the guy tells me on the phone, at this point I'm on the phone talking, and he's like, no, that's different. I said, really? So how different is it than me taking a picture of the ID of the pole? It even says pole ID. You know, at the time it's, you know, New York Telephone, but now it's Verizon, so the tag is kind of old. How is it that you can't figure this one out? After about two or three calls, I finally gave up. I said, okay, I'm making a phone call to the president's line. That's the classic, you know, the phone company president line, which is actually the PR office, public relations office. And I call him up. I said, here's the deal. I work for organization C. This organization has many other entities that do things in the news environment. Maybe you've heard the name Katie Couric, or, you know, other names of that sort, Mike Wallace. I'd be really interested in passing along to them this story just for fun, maybe over lunch. Can you help me out? Well, 2 hours later, I got a call from a guy who's apologetic. He says, you were talking to somebody who's not familiar with our systems. He's from a different part of the company. He's recently been transferred. I'm like, right. Was he the guy at the radar station in Siberia? Was he the guy at the radar station at the Arctic Circle? Because where did you find this guy? Well, lo and behold, the circuit is on its way in. But, you know, again, it's like, come on. You're in the communications business. This is what you've been doing. You've developed the standards by which we use these circuits. How could you not have people on staff to install them and properly do this?
Not everybody has Katie Couric or Dan Rather on staff that can throw out names
like that.
This
is true. Not that they would even talk to me or even like, why are you talking? Why would I want to even talk about this? You know, but it's always fun to be able to say.
I think I have in such situations used the name of my business partner, the radio station's Larry Fuss. If you can't get this working, I'm going to get Larry Fuss to call you. You're not going to like that one bit.
That's the name.
Hey, Mr. Tar, you got a peeve or two, don't you?
Yeah, except that, you know, last time I tried to get Katie Couric to do anything about it, they just pulled out that restraining order and it went all the heck after that. But, you know, there's an old saying, and I use it completely in jest, but my job would be great if it weren't for DJs and salespeople, which is entirely untrue. I love the people I work with. But, you know, my pet peeve a lot of times lies in the care and feeding of the engineer. You know, I don't know how many times I've gotten a request for something, and the first thing they'll say is, my computer took 30 minutes to boot up. And you know, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, by about minute number four, I would have called somebody. So, you know, it's you know, things like, you know, the manipulation of words to try to get me to react to something. You know, I would fix it either way if it was booting in 90 seconds instead of a minute, or, you know, you don't have to tell me that it's, you know, it's taking you 20 minutes to boot your computer and it's taking you 30 minutes to get your email. And, oh, my God, your largest client is waiting for you to get this email. We're going to lose all this money if you don't get it. I know it's not true. So don't tell me that. It's OK. So, you know, I do use that as an opportunity very nicely, you know, to kind of point out that really all I need to know are the facts, you know, and. Amazingly, too, when I go to these same computers and I go, it took you 20 minutes to boot your computer. Let's boot it up. 90 seconds later, it's back up online. Oh, well, you're here. It doesn't do it when you're here. So I would say, you know, one of my biggest pet peeves with that is kind of the what I like to call the Jack Webb, just the facts, ma'am. You know, I try to tell my people that, you know, as much as I understand how frustrated they are, and it's true. You know, it may be the only problem in their day. In mine, it's one of 20 that I have to deal with. And, you know, the quicker you can get me the information and as concise as you can be about it, the faster I'm going to be able to solve it. Because, you know, if you tell me that it takes 20 minutes to boot your computer, that doesn't really help me fix it. Now, if you tell me that you downloaded and ran a virus and you've hosed your computer up and that's why, that's information I can use. You know, that way I don't have to hunt to find out what happened, you know, because maybe they're embarrassed about it or whatever, and they did something they shouldn't have done, and they come to me and just say, well, it doesn't work. Well, you know, I have that problem, too, with studio equipment, where, you know, studio equipment magically breaks and nobody says anything until 3 days later, and I get an email from the morning show going, ah, this doesn't work. This is the end of the world. It hasn't worked for 3 days, and you're just telling me now? You know? And what happens is the person that broke it just kind of doesn't say anything, and so, you know, that's my biggest thing. Just, you know, tell me right away and tell me exactly what happened, because that way it makes it a whole lot easier to fix. And when you can, you know, it just saves a lot of time and a lot of detective work. If I already know that, yeah, you were doing this to this button and it broke off. Well, that's good to know. Maybe I can redesign it so that doesn't happen. You know, don't just say it doesn't work. You know, that's my favorite one is, what's wrong with it? It doesn't work. Well, define what doesn't work about it. You know, can you not push the button in? Can you push it in? Nothing happens. Do you look at it? It springs out. You know, what is it that doesn't work? So, I you know, to kind of boil it down to the bottom line is, you know, my pet peeve is just, you know, is a lack of, you know, being concise on things like problem reports. Just tell me exactly what it is, what you were doing, when it happened, and what's wrong. And I can get it fixed right away.
It's an interesting.
Yeah, I would say I have a pet peeve like that. Oh, sorry, Kurt.
It's an interesting dilemma because you know we work with a lot of non-technical people, And we're, to us, being technical is just part of everyday life. And if something didn't work when I did something, you know, I'd make a mental note. I'd plug that little piece into a part of my brain that says, you know, when I push this, I get this on the screen instead of that on the screen. And working with a manufacturer at Telos, I know our tech support guys are all the time dealing with incoming emails and phone calls, people saying this doesn't work, and yet oftentimes the person who's making the call has no idea how it's supposed to work. They don't know what the right behavior looks like. They only know that usually when they push this button, within a few seconds, they're talking to somebody or they're hearing a caller or whatever, or the preset changes or something, and it's not doing it now. And so I wonder, I mean, how far can an engineer like us go, a technical person go, to get into the mind of the person making the complaint? And what should we expect from them? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Part of that is, and that's, you know, what I'm saying is, what I'm talking about is the pet peeve side. There's also another side of that, which is people are human, and we are dealing with people who aren't technical, and sometimes they can't describe what the issue is. And that's where, you know, we have to, as engineers, do a better job of asking the right questions. Because, you know, as much as I'd like for people to always be concise and write down exactly what happened, sometimes they don't know how to describe it, or they don't know exactly what it was. And that's where, you know, I'll go through those kind of quizzes when I'm talking to these people and go, okay, so what were you doing when it happened? Okay, what happens when you do this? You know, what happens when you do that? And explain that I just need to have these notes so that when I come over to take care of the issue, I can, you know, take care of it fast and get you on your way. So, I mean, it's real easy as technical guys just kind of get that attitude. And that's what, you know, that's kind of the danger. You know, I joke about, you know, these guys being my pet peeves. But, you know, if you have that attitude with them, you're not going to get anywhere. And it's wrong, you know, because, again, it is the biggest problem of their day. And you know, our job is to make sure things work for them. But sometimes, you know, it helps if you do a little coaching and understand that, you know, really the problem is, you know, computers are a language unto themselves. Some of us are very fluent in computers and transmitters and studio equipment, and others aren't. And it's our job to kind of bridge that gap. And, you know, so we as engineers need to do a real good job of, you know, first of all, not making these guys feel stupid about it. And it's real easy to go, well, duh. you know, but also understand that not everybody knows these technical things as well as we do. And we're the guys that you know, are kind of the enablers to enable these people to use that technology. So we need to keep that in the back of our mind and sometimes work to get the answers we need and just say, okay, what were you doing? What was going on? Did it really take 20 minutes or did it just seem like 20 minutes? That kind of thing.
from the chat room, somebody says that they did have a computer that somebody said, hey, it's taken 40 minutes to boot. And the guy, yeah, right, right. The guy goes there, and sure enough, it takes 40 minutes to boot.
Or and it happens. I've had somebody, you know, on the other hand, I've had somebody.
I said, I embellished. It was 25 minutes, and the problem was a bad secondary hard drive. Pulled the secondary hard drive out and booted it in 20 seconds. So sometimes you do have to believe it. And Navion from the chat room pointed out that his peeve is the guy that says, the whole network is down. When really his foot just hit the power strip switch under the desk and his screen went dark.
Sure, I had a guy who said his computer wouldn't boot up and his monitor was turned off.
Yes. Yeah, we have that. I get that at least once or twice a week. Those are the good ones. That Chris, along with the internet is down.
A couple of times. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. The other pet peeve I have is going along with Chris says, yeah, you can't expect non-technical folks to understand all the intricacies of a computer and what it connects to. But the great phone call in the engineering shop is always, hey, did you know that the internet is down? Like, really? Why don't you enlighten me? And they go to explain what's going on. And I was like, oh, how about trying this? What? How many windows did you open up in your browser? How many little tabs do you have? Why? Sometimes the internet only lets you have five of them at a time. If you had six, you might want to try five. So I'm figuring at this point the person on the other end of the phone is going to be yelling at me saying you're being sarcastic, you're an engineering type. I hear this clicking on the keyboard and they go, oh my goodness, you fixed the internet. Oh, I'll have to remember that and click to hang up the phone before I have a chance to say anything. I'm like, okay.
Well, remember that if it works,
why not? You know, I was trying to be comical just because I know they don't get it. And you know, it just made sense. And then I have the other classic is when salespeople get angry at failing to make a close a deal and lose their temper on the phone. They do something very bad to the phone instrument itself. So I get the phone call from a different extension, and they'll tell me, "Hey, my phone stopped working." Really? What exactly is it plugged in? Is it lighting up? Oh yeah, it lights up. You know, everything's there, but I just can't make phone calls. Oh, when was the last time, and what were you doing when it happened? I was on the phone with a client. It just stopped after that. Oh, all right, fine. Well, we have these new IP phone PBX, and once in a while, static electricity. If you zap the phone just the right way, it locks up the unit. No big deal. I go up to the office. I look at the phone instrument, and it has an LCD display, as you can imagine. He was very upset with that last caller he had, that client. Took the back end of the handset and made it put it in contact with the LCD screen. As we all know, impaling an LCD screen with the back of a handset has very, very negative results. And I just looked at him. I said, "Did you notice the broken screen?" He goes, "Yeah, I'm not sure how that happened." I was like, "You know, you're absolutely right. I have no idea how it happened either. What I can tell you is I can't fix this right away. You'll have to wait for me to find another phone for you." "But you don't understand. I got to make calls." I said, "Yeah, you're absolutely right. I don't understand. Because if you had found out how that screen got broken, we could have probably brought a phone to your office and prevented this from furthering your inability to get the job done." "Oh, well, yeah, you're right. Well, I was kind of upset on the phone." "So you think that's what caused it?" "Well, yeah, and the back of the handset the plastic is actually cracked." I was doing Jack Webb. You know, it was like Dragnet. I'm like, "So, what you're saying is you had an incident on the phone, you lost control, and you took it out on the phone itself." And the person looks at me like, "Well, yeah, that's sort of how it went." Now, the person at the other end of the phone, did they respond in kind? Do you think that they did the same to their phone, or were they still in conversation? He goes, "Well, you know, I don't know. The phone hung up after that, and I couldn't get back to them." "All right. So you think I can take about an hour or so, get you a new phone, and you'll be okay?" "Well, yeah, if you need the afternoon, I'm going to be on the road. I'll use my cell phone." It was as if nothing happened. I was just like, "Wow, I feel like I'm in office space. Let's continue on with this train of thought."
I'll tell you what, I had an issue just today, as a matter of fact, and I had it on my, joked about it on my Facebook. I got in this morning and got pulled in by an employee and said, "I think I got a virus on my computer or something. I'm not sure what's going on." And I said, "Well, you know, what happened? You know, let's take a look." "Well, I was checking my Yahoo email and I opened up something from a friend of mine, and all of a sudden my computer got really messed up. I don't know why." And I'm thinking, well, I'm no rocket scientist, but I think I know why. And I, you know, one of the complaints I had as I, you know, retelling the story is, I literally spent 2 hours cleaning the junkware out of this computer and getting it running again. And the whole time he was angry because it was taking so long. And I'm thinking to myself, all right, you broke company policy. You went to your webmail. You opened up something that was a virus. You messed it up. And you're getting mad because I'm not moving fast enough. Tell you what, just a simple thank you would have been great. You know, I mean, I would have taken that. So, yeah, you know, some of that stuff's just unavoidable. And, you know, service with a smile, I still went and got it done and got it back in business. But it's just, you know, it's funny how, you know, these people just don't understand that. First of all, we'll find out. And most of the time, it's okay. I mean, my job is to fix broken things. So if things break, it's not the end of the world. I can fix them. But it certainly helps if you're upfront about it.
Yeah, I was wondering where our pet peeves would go. Because at the beginning of the segment, I've said, you know, is it equipment, design, tech support, people? And look at what it's almost all been. It's been humorous, but it's been about people.
Well, other than like TELUS equipment, TELUS equipment drives me nuts.
Oh, please. Are you kidding me? The TELUS, you know, the 2x12.
You know, I call them and—
The Zephyr Extreme, the Zephyr Classic, which is a great one. They don't make anymore. I don't get this. It's like, what happened? You know, the Extreme, yeah, I got to reboot it because the display doesn't look right. I'm making a difference. Are you kidding?
And now we're devolving into Seinfeld. Oh, tell us, what's up with that? Hey. I mean, really, hey guys, who uses the TELUS?
Fine. You know, there's this Comrex box I had, and it doesn't, I don't know what the hell. It's got no dial knobs, nothing. It's a silver front. It just doesn't do anything. Oh, and then there was that other one that was that.
Here's a pet peeve of some manufacturers, and this has gone around our company, Telus Omni and Axia, a couple of times. It's when a customer has a problem with a piece of gear. Let's say it's a piece of Telus or Omni or Axia gear, and rather than contact our tech support, which we spend, and most companies, other broadcast equipment manufacturers spend a lot of money on. Doesn't always seem efficient. Sometimes it really is. Sometimes it really isn't. But instead of coming to our tech support line by phone or by email, oftentimes people will go to one of the broadcast listservs. And some people will spout off about what's wrong, or some people will ask a question reasonably. And you know what? Sometimes that is a good resource. But I would think that it's a resource that's best for when tech support isn't available for your product. Maybe you have, you know, an ITC premium line cart machine that you want to find a part for or get fixed. Well, there isn't tech support for that anymore. But so often, I mean, I can tell you literally dozens and dozens of times a day that the Telus and Omnia and Axia tech support guys give authoritative, up-to-date, positive answers to solve people's problems. And I'm sure that other manufacturers do that as well. I'm sure Comrex and Harris and Wheatstone and everybody that makes stuff. And whenever I had an issue, I mean, years and years ago with an Orban processor, I'd call, talk to somebody in their tech support. I think usually it may have been Chris Holt, and got an answer quickly, got a part sent out for free, and got the thing resolved. So I'm just saying that why don't you give the manufacturer the first effort at fixing the problem, especially tech support is offered at no charge.
There is another side to that, however, and you're right. I 99.9% of the time will go through tech support, but there are situations where, for example, and your company excluded, there are some companies who kind of use their tech support and their parts as sort of a profit center, if you put it nicely. Yeah. And you know, sometimes when I call, I'm not looking for an entire board. I'm not looking for an entire gadget when I know it's just it's a simple part that could probably easily be field replaced, but they don't make any money selling you a 49-cent part, so they won't tell you that. They'll go, oh, you can't do that. It doesn't work that way. And you know it does, and it just takes, you know, you're just right on the cusp of finding that answer out. So the flip side of that is that, a lot of customer support places are in the business of selling more parts. And generally, it used to be where, and I know Nautel's pretty good about this, where you can actually go to Nautel online and order individual components for their transmitters if you don't want to replace an entire module. So I think, to be fair, there are some times when going through technical support, for a component or for broadcast equipment, sometimes isn't the best way. Now, most of the time it is, but I think there are times when that's not the case.
And I guess you got to figure that company by company, because I know that we've seen things go on listservs. And hey, I use the listservs, especially when I was doing contract engineering full time, I really used them a lot to get information. But it usually wasn't equipment specific information, such that, you know, well, so often I'll see on a listserv, not so often, we used to see a lot more of this information on a listserv that was just plain wrong. Hey, no, that's the wrong advice. That's not what you want to do with that. God, and so, we actually had people watching the listservs. When somebody asked a question, if they got good advice, hey, hands off. But if they got the answer that was, oh, no, he's getting the wrong answer on this, let's give him a call first thing in the morning. And our tech support guys would give the guy a call or an email first thing in the morning and give him the straight story on that. One of the, I guess, unfortunate things about modern construction techniques is, you know, so often we as engineers, we have wanted and to be able to fix something, maybe at the component level in the past. Back, hey, we had Bill Sachs and his wife Kim on a few weeks ago, and they were talking about, you know, choosing capacitors and for component replacement. And we were joking about how, hey, I miss the days of, you know, replacing 4.7 microfarad capacitors in ITC cart machines. I made a bunch of money at that. Nowadays, most circuit boards that are made are all service mount devices. And if you don't have the right gear to fix that in the field, you're going to do a bad job of it, and you're probably going to make the problem worse. And that's the fact that we live with. It comes about, though, at the same time that engineers today don't necessarily have the time or the knowledge as much to troubleshoot to the component level. So the fact that you can't, or it's hard to replace the component on a service mount product, is not necessarily a bad thing, because you may not have time to get to that level. It's a lot more spend-wise to send the product in to have it replaced, or to get it down to at least the board level and swap the board out. Mr. Tobin, go ahead. You were trying to say something.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. No, I was going to say that, you know, today's circuit boards are multi-layered circuit boards. You know, back in the day, glass epoxy was one layer, and that was it. The trace you saw is what you saw. Now you have, you know, seven layers of traces all the way through, so too much heat on one lead and everything is gone. Yeah, it's not easy to surface anymore. But kidding aside, before when I was talking about Telos and Comrex and stuff, I've had very, very positive support from the Telos Omnia Axia folks as well as Comrex. But there have been other manufacturers that I agree with Chris. They try to use their support as profit centers and unfortunately do take advantage of those who may not be as well-versed in the technology and support or, you know, repair capabilities of their product. So you do, you know, user beware, I guess is what I would say.
Hey, we need to hit our picks of the week real quick because we're about out of time. So let's get right to it. Who's got one ready? If you don't, I do. Jump in.
I have, this is Chris. Okay. Recently, in the last couple of days, I've had folks at the office asking about USB devices and all the weird things that they've been going on with webcams to mice and keyboards as well as audio devices. So I'd sent a couple of folks in the direction of USB.org. And I thought, well, let's see what happens. So far, the 3 out of 5 folks came back to me with positive results saying it was the best thing I could have done. They've learned more about USB and what it's doing and actually were able to solve problems with their computer installations. So I'm going to offer up USB.org as a pick of the week.
Cool. All right. Mr. Tarr, what have you got for us?
Yes, I just hang on a second here. Let me get the link off the private chat there to get it posted. This one, a lot of engineers, broadcast engineers know about. Those of you who don't, though, it's a handy tool. If you go to contelec.com, that's short for Continental Electronics, they have a great piece of software free called eSlide. And it does have, there is a little bit of a sales pitch in the software, but you look past that, and it does some great calculations for planning out FM transmission systems. I use it actually quite a bit. You can do, if you're designing a system or doing a what-if on building one, it's a great tool.
Very cool. All right, that's at contelec.com. We'll have that in the show notes. All right, here's my pick of the week. This is a guy and his website, and he is a consulting engineer. His name is Chris Scott, and the website is scott-inc.com. So it's scott-inc.com. It's Chris Scott and Associates. Chris is out of the Bowling Green, Kentucky area, and Chris manufactures a number of items that are really helpful to broadcast engineers. One of them is the LP3 standard H-field loop antenna, and that's for making AM, NRSC, and harmonic testing measurements. I have owned a couple of those myself. He also makes a tunable AM notch filter. This will help you in notching out AM wherever you need to, but typically in NRSC measurements. Also, he makes some notch filters for the VHF high band and UHF for if you have for example, if you're trying to pick up, also for the FM band. So if you're trying to run a translator site and you've got some nearby RF, you can use his filters to notch that way out. We've used those in American Samoa, where there are really only two main transmitter sites. And we have, there's a lot of RF at each one. We're having to notch out stuff that's right next door to us on the spectrum. So check out Chris Scott's website. Very handy things. Scott-inc.com. Chris Scott and Associates will have those on the show notes. And he's in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Guys, we got to wrap it up. Any last quick notes before we go? Something you got to say?
No, I'm good.
We'll catch everybody next week then. Hey, thanks for listening. And you can get this podcast in the iTunes store and have it delivered to your computer or your iDevice. Just go to the iTunes store and search for TWIRT, TWIRT, as in This Week in Radio Tech. You can check out the website too at thisweekinradiotech.com. You can download the show from there. You can listen to the show right from that website. And you can also add your own notes to our show notes if you'd like to add to them. We sure would appreciate it if you would. And finally, be sure you friend us on Facebook. If you have a Facebook account, and hundreds of my engineer friends do,
Well, just search in the top search box there. Search for TWIRT, T-W-I-R-T. Should pop right up there. And like us or friend us or whatever you need to do there on the Twitter or the Facebook or the interwebs. And we'll keep you up to date with what's going on. You can also play the show right from our Facebook page. So lots of cool ways to do it. Chris Tobin from New York City, thanks for being with us today. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. And have a good one.
And Chris Tarr from Muckwonago, Wisconsin, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We'll have you again next week, okay? We'll see you next week. Thanks for joining us on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.
This week's episode is brought to you by Axia Audio. With over 2,000 consoles on air, Axia is the leader in IP audio. Now, with the new power station that's plug and play, it's the easiest too. Check them out at axiaaudio.com.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another twirt has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes Store.
Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here.
Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penelope Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.